You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
This is The Brian Callen Show without Brian Callen, because Brian Callen is off in the woods hunting something, but we're here in Los Angeles hunting for truth, justice, and universal order with Vanessa C. Tyson. Welcome back for round four.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
I'm going to again float the possibility that we talk about districting, but
sure.
I'm in no way expecting that to happen. I figure if I keep my expectations nice and low,
there you go.
There can be no disappointment.
Well, I don't think you need to lower your expectations. I think you might need to
have no expectations.
Vary them a
as
bit.
The Buddha would teach.
Good to be flexible.
That's right. It is. If only my Achilles was. Let's at least start off on the topic of districting.
Sure.
Tell us a little bit about the history of districting, you know, where districting has gone wrong, districting in theory and districting in practice.
Okay. So the history of districting is, you know, written into the Constitution, basically, states must take a census every 10 years, and then you must redistrict accordingly so that, you know, design the districts themselves, whether you're talking about congressional districts, also state districts for state senates and state assemblies or state houses, depending upon which your state calls it. And so redistricting has long been a method both of, you know, kind of privileging some and disenfranchising others. And I'll explain kind of how this happens. First, districting is about how you draw the lines around a given neighborhood or a given entity. And governments, right, usually state governments, are in charge of doing all of the redistricting. And what they do is they try to draw maps. What they currently do is that they draw maps neighborhood by neighborhood to try to get a number of districts that are equally proportional, right? So roughly the same population. In the past, this wasn't the case. And I think the best example would be in the South, areas like Memphis, Tennessee, or the state of Tennessee in general. You have a number of court cases that happened in the 60s. And the reason why they went down, why the Supreme Court actually intervened, was because the districts were drawn disproportionately and they, you know, specifically left out and or disenfranchised a number of blacks. And how they did so was roughly this. They said, you know, I mean, a district in an urban area, right, where many blacks were residing, on average, you know, could have as much, the proportion could be as much as 41-1 in terms of the number of African Americans versus a small district where, you know, like where you would have one white person in a rural district. What this does, however, is that if you had a ratio of 41-1, right, that one white person's vote in a rural district was the equivalent of 41 black votes, right? So we come up with in the 1960s with this rule of one person, one vote. That had not been in place.
Can we talk about that? Like, just break that down.
Yeah.
In the 1960s, we came up with this rule of one person, one vote. It took us
yes.
the middle of the 60s to get there.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty much. So you and I have discussed this before, the fact that, you know, the ratio of the sizes of states, you know, like and when we talk about the Senate, right, that, you know, when this country was created, the ratio of the largest state to the smallest state in terms of population was about 12-1.
Mm-hmm.
And right now we're looking at it being 70-1,
mm-hmm.
right? But it wasn't until the 1960s even that you had a House of Representatives that was actually, you know, that was actually proportional to the, you know, where you had these districts drawn that were actually proportional to the number of persons in the district, that
mm-hmm.
they were, you know, roughly equivalent. So it wasn't until the 1960s you had three specific cases, Baker v. Carr,
mm-hmm.
Westbury v. Sanders, and Reynolds v. Sims.
Are these Supreme Court cases?
These are Supreme Court
yeah.
cases. First, that established that it was justiciable. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that was that the Baker v. Carr, while it didn't necessarily make any specific differences, what
mm-hmm.
they said was that this was an equal protection clause violation,
mm-hmm.
right? And therefore, because it was a violation of the 14th Amendment, the equal protection clause, that the Supreme Court could then intervene.
Mm-hmm.
From there, you have Reynolds v. Sims and the Westbury v. Sanders cases where the Supreme Court did decide, basically handed down the one person, one vote, both for first for congressional districts and then for state Senate and state House districts.
Now, is this all under the Warren Court?
Yes, though this was all Warren.
One of the great, great things to come out of California, Earl Warren.
Yes, yes.
Now, but wait a minute. Let's back up a little bit because obviously,
of course.
I understand why you're starting there. But mm-hmm. Messing around with districts happened way, way, way before this, right?
Oh,
I
certainly.
Mean, even the term gerrymander. Where does that come from?
Sure. So Elbridge Gerry, former governor of Massachusetts, was one of the things that he
and
was.
And when we're talking
for.
Former, we're talking really former.
This is early 1800s, I think.
Yeah. 1830s, maybe.
Yeah. And so the issue with Elbridge Gerry was that, largely he wanted districts that would, conform or that would be drawn in such a way to benefit his political agenda. And so these districts, one was drawn across the state of Massachusetts that looked a bit like a salamander. And thus you have the Elbridge Gerry salamander. It becomes a gerrymander. Gerrymandering is actually completely legal.
Mm-hmm.
With a couple caveats, right? Because the Supreme Court really hasn't intervened very mm-hmm. much in terms of partisan gerrymandering. And so if you want to have partisan gerrymanders, you simply, you put all Republicans in one district or all Democrats in one district, or, you may draw ridiculous.
And that's known as packing, right?
Yeah.
And there's also cracking.
Cracking is where you break them up.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So you basically say, OK, I want to disenfranchise black people or disenfranchise Republicans or disenfranchise whomever. Right. And if they live in the same geographic district, or the same geographic area, you basically draw district lines that would break it up, break that group up. And, usually in four or more pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That effectively means that they will constitute a minority, a small minority in each of those four surrounding districts.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, they have been cracked apart, and in so doing, their power has been minimized.
Right. So, let's say you've got a population there, right? A sizable mm-hmm. population. Your options are pack them in one district so
mm-hmm.
that essentially they have 100% majority in that district.
Exactly.
And therefore, they waste, a lot of them end up in inverted commas wasting their votes,
yep.
right?
Yep.
And then you can have three surrounding districts that will go to whoever you want.
Yep.
Or if you're really greedy and cunning, right, you can crack that population up and then you have four seats going to whoever you want, and then that population gets no seats.
Yes.
Right.
Now, there's another thing that you can also do, which gets kind of fun, especially if you look at, for instance, the state of Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
It's called kidnapping, right? And I know. Don't worry. This is not illegal. Or at least it, and,
well,
and
or
it doesn't.
Do worry that it is not illegal.
Okay, yeah. Do worry that it's not illegal.
Yeah.
Don't worry, there aren't any actual children involved,
yeah.
no matter what the maturity level is. So here's the deal. So what you can do is you can redraw a district that basically cuts out the member of Congress or the state senator or the House the representative, that basically cuts them out of the district that they've been representing, say, for the last 10 years,
mm.
right? So they have one of two choices. They can either move,
mm-hmm.
right, actually relocate so that they can run again in the district that they've basically been representing for the last 2 years, or they have to run in an entirely new district where the likelihood that they will lose increases considerably, right?
Right.
So kidnapping, it tends to be fairly popular, simply because, if you have a state government that is, say, highly Republican, and
mm-hmm.
yet you have a congressional delegation that may be, moderate to, or one-to-one, right? Then a lot of the time state governments will try to, district somebody out of their district, by drawing the district in such a way to where they no longer live in it.
So, for example, right, let's pick a city.
Okay. The best example was an incumbent from Pennsylvania, actually,
mm-hmm.
in the 1990
mm-hmm.
redistricting, who was drawn out of his district. And he was not
so
very
where
happy.
Was he from? And then how did they draw that district?
He was outside of Johnstown or whatever,
okay.
which was but he had been a Democrat. And so
mm-hmm.
he was a Democrat representing, and his district extended into Pittsburgh, but then he got drawn out of it. So basically he was drawn into an overwhelmingly Republican district.
And rural, probably.
Yes,
yeah.
And rural, which meant that, you know, he lost.
Right, right. And so then his choice...
And there was nothing Jack Murtha could do about it.
Right. And so then his choice would have been either to move into Pittsburgh...
Yep.
And then,
but then have to run against, you know, an incumbent.
Incumbent in Pittsburgh, right? And probably betray his own, in inverted commas, betray his own party, potentially.
Certainly.
Right? And then, or alternatively, try and win this district that is nothing like his policies.
Certainly. Well, I mean, right. And another thing that we've seen happen, and this gets, you know, so you have packing, cracking, kidnapping, and then the final one that we don't really have a name for, but it's when a state actually loses a congressional district. So the reapportionment process, the way it works is that you have the U.S. Senate, the United States Census, right? You decide how, or you find out how many people actually live in a given state. Once that occurs, then we have reapportionment.
And that's why we have a census. Like,
yes.
We don't have a census because, you know, just for shits and giggles. Like,
yeah.
It's specifically so that we can make sure, theoretically, that districts are fair.
Yeah, yeah. You know, but I mean, well, sure. Sure.
That's for the theory.
That's the theory, and that I would say holds now, though it hasn't always been the case. Now, here's the deal. After the reapportionment, it may be something where a certain state, you know, who has a growing population, such as California or you know, like a handful of the Southwest and what have you, Texas gained some districts. They gain districts, but other states lose districts. And this is where it becomes very interesting, because what you may find is that, you know, certain states, Michigan, case in point, like great example, Michigan, the population, particularly around the area of Detroit, has decreased substantially. So not only did they, you know, not only did the population decrease, but as such, so did the number of congressional districts. But it was a large point of the, you know, the population decrease was in Detroit, which is, you know, longtime Democratic, well, you know, democratically held. So you had two Democratic incumbents running against each other, right? Literally running against each other for the same seat. And this was in, I think, just after the 2000 census. And this did not help. It was, I think it was John Dingell who eventually won out. But it became a very nasty battle because it left much of the Democratic caucus in Congress, but as well as in the state of Michigan, highly divided.
So
par for the course.
Right. But I mean, that presumably is, I mean, it may not be fun for them, but for citizens, that's a good thing, right? That essentially, you know, the population is being redivided. Like if the districts were well drawn, right, you would want it to be that the population is reflective of the level of Congress people and so on.
Sure. But there's a loss there in the sense that you may have two incredibly well-versed, highly intelligent persons, incumbents running against each other. And you know, there is a loss there that makes you question the geographic district model, which is, you know, like, I mean, as opposed to, say, proportional representation, right?
Now, wait a minute. So take us down that road. Where does that go?
Sure, sure. So,
I like comparison shopping.
Okay.
It's better than Amazon.
All right. So the geographic district model looks a little something like this. Basically, you draw these lines around geographic districts. So it's a geographic, you know, area, right, where each district comes from. And what you have through that is that you have one winner from each district. Now, this can be a problem for a number of reasons. Okay. First reason is that, you know, you specifically with having a winner-take-all, you know, single member district, because you only have one winner, so single member. The winner take all single member district means that whoever loses, right, is basically disenfranchised. What do I mean by that? It means that their vote goes down the drain. They have to hope.
I think you got to break this down for us more, because we're just so used to winner take all that we don't even understand that there are other systems that exist out there.
So you have to hope that. You know, that your new winner might do something. But imagine if you had, say, three persons from a given district, right? You know, then that way, for instance, in this case in Detroit, right, it could have been something where you would have had, you know, in this case, you know, those two Democrats as well as one Republican representing that district, right? So essentially, you could have had, you know, you could build a system that doesn't have one person win but rather that has the top three candidates that win. And you have a better chance of having the interests and the preferences of that of their constituents represented.
But you're talking about then you'd need a super district.
Sure. But I mean, but you could do that in a number of ways. Now, the other thing is that you could get rid of the geographic model altogether. Right. And what you could say is, you know, like if you wanted to vote along party lines, vote along party lines, vote along parties based upon their platforms and their ideas. And then, you know, from there, if you wanted to participate in proportional representation, you know, on a state by state basis, for instance, California has 53 congressional districts right now. True story. Now, here's the deal. With the California delegation, if you wanted to do proportional representation, what you simply could say would be that, you know, the top Democrats would, you know, get their percentage of the seats allocated, and then the top Republicans would get their percentage of the seats allocated, and that they would be allocated or distributed, you know, proportionally to the amount of votes that the parties got, right? And ostensibly, this also encourages third parties. Reason being, and this is something that I highly encourage, right, is that, you know, third party candidates may have better platforms and better ideas than the Democrats or the Republicans, right? You know, now the Democrats and the Republicans probably don't want to hear me saying this, right? Like they would rather, you know, kind of have their monopoly as it is without having to contend with any outside issues.
And to break that down, right, the current system, right, let's talk about how the current system of winner-take-all favors a two-party system or inevitably creates a two-party system.
Sure, because if anyone wants to vote for a third party, and I know there are times when I want to vote for a third party, the reality is that if you vote for a third party, what it may do is it may help the party that you like the least, right? So if you don't vote for one of the two parties of the, you know, the Democrats or the Republicans, then are you essentially throwing away your vote because it is actually helping either party that you hate the most, right? And that's kind of like, you know, so it becomes like this, the devil is in the details, which is, which party do you vote for? Because, you know, do you vote for the one you hate or the one you really hate? And that kind of depresses turnout as well. I mean, and again, if we want to have a strong democracy, then we need to have, you know, rules in place that actually encourage turnout.
Right. So if you've ever wondered why it is that you find yourself voting for the person you hate least,
exactly,
it's because of winner-take-all elections. Like, that sets up that system. And so if you want to actually vote for a candidate that you like, you have to fundamentally change the way that elections are structured.
Case in point, when we talk about Ralph Nader running as a third candidate in 2000, right? Now, we know that of the Democrats and the Republicans, most of the people who were voting for Ralph Nader would have supported, you know, Al Gore, or at least hated Al Gore less than they they hated George W. Bush, right? The difficulty, however, becomes, and we've done this, you know, you can break down the statistical models. If the people who had voted for Ralph Nader, if their votes had gone to Al Gore certainly would have won without a doubt, right? And all sorts of statisticians have run the numbers over and over again. There's no question. I mean, just alone in Florida, that wouldn't have been the issue. So then the question becomes kind of even structures, right? And I'm a big believer in structures and the idea that the rules of the game dictate the outcomes of the game. So what I mean by that is that, you know, one thing that we have to consider beyond proportional representation and beyond the idea of, you know, kind of single member districts is this idea of instant runoff voting. And what do I mean by that? Okay, I know. I'm just taking you all on a tangent, but I love this.
No,
so
not on a tangent. Down the rabbit hole. I'm excited. Where does it lead?
Ooh, yes. This is sexy, people. This
is sexy. We're
going
through the looking glass here.
Yeah. So with instant runoff voting, and we've seen this, you know, in a handful of different types of elections, board of trustees oftentimes use this, you know, various elections that I have to vote in, whether or not I like it. Right, is that instant runoff voting in many cases will actually allow you to rank your preferences, right? So what does that mean? It would mean that, like, I could have voted for Ralph Nader, you know, in 2000, right? But understanding that if he lost, right, if he got ruled out in the first round, that my second round vote, my second preference, could have then gone to Al Gore. mm-hmm. right? Something of that nature, to the effect where even if, you know, you can vote your preference, but extend that your preferences or kind of express your preferences in a different way by saying, who's my second choice? Now,
question.
What, of course.
So, you know, I mean, a large part of what came out of Florida in 2000 mm-hmm. was the idea that the ballots were too complicated, right? Mm-hmm. And that that complexity disenfranchised voters, mm-hmm. right? Is there anything to be said for the idea that maybe all of these, you know, I mean, we haven't switched the system yet,
sure.
but that some of these systems might disenfranchise voters by nature of their complexity?
You know, you can say that, and yet I want to say no. Mm-hmm. And here's the reason why. Is it, you know, simply because we've been raised under one paradigm, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is, and the paradigm that we've been raised, I mean, that is prevalent in the United States, that mm-hmm. everyone is kind of raised up in, is this single member districts, winner take all, two party system,
mm-hmm.
right? I think we can learn. Right. I mean, you can get the word out and people can learn. I mean, we're mm-hmm. seeing even in instant runoff voting, one of the benefits of instant runoff voting, just by being able to play, you know, by being able to rank your choices first, second, third.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Is that we've seen candidates get a lot more conciliatory, a lot less negative.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And a lot more willing to kind of engage with the opposition.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is, let's say I'm like a liberal Democrat, for instance, you know, this hypothetically, of course. Right. Now, here's the deal. The idea becomes that I don't necessarily want to alienate anybody from any party, because I'm hoping that if I'm not their first choice, maybe I'm their second.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not necessarily going to pander to everybody, but what I will do is work hard to engage the entire electorate and not just simply my base,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's a key kind of difference in terms of what we see right now, which is very much about, A, energizing your base, but secondly, alienating the opposition.
Mm-hmm.
And negative, and we... Again, statistics have shown that negative advertising, right, depresses turnout. People mm-hmm. just don't want to go to the polls. They're like,
right.
well, he's an a-hole and she's an a-hole. I'm going to stay home and I'm going to watch my Dodgers.
Yes, that's a very Angelino-centric attitude. But here's the other question, right?
Sure.
In terms of... It's not just that, right? Because so many of these congressmen have essentially safe districts,
yep.
right? So they don't even, it's not even about energizing the base. Like, you know, you're playing to a captive audience, because
sure.
realistically, you know, if my congressman is Henry Waxman, right, or it mm-hmm. was, now that
sure.
he's retiring, but, you know, Henry Waxman, did Henry Waxman ever have to really worry about reelection as a Democrat in, you know, the middle of Los Angeles, all of the wealthy limousine liberal parts? No,
yeah.
of course not.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he didn't even really have to energize his base. I don't, what has Henry Waxman ever sent me? Like, he was in Congress for, you know, decades and decades. What percentage of these people have safe seats?
Oh, dear. If you wanted to think about I mean, roughly 90%.
Right. So,
yeah.
I mean, essentially 90% of these people have, you know, something like an aristocracy, right? Where they basically,
certainly.
You know, you get, it's like getting elected the first time is hard, but then mm-hmm. once you do it the second time and the third time and the fourth time and all that sort of stuff. So do we, I have many questions, but,
sure, sure, sure.
but one question is certainly term limits, which
mm-hmm.
is something that gets floated a lot.
Sure.
What are the consequences of those? Would they be good? Would they be bad? Also, how important is geographic representation? Like, because, I mean, if you think about in terms of the 13 colonies, mm-hmm. right, there were obviously, being from Massachusetts was a very different thing from being from Virginia, and you had
Certainly.
Very different interests. For
mm-hmm.
example, you know, being a farmer,
mm-hmm.
wanting to keep slaves,
sure.
versus, you know, being from Massachusetts and wanting, you know, roads, being a Federalist, being all those
mm-hmm.
sorts of things. So there are real differences there. Nowadays, it's entirely possible, and I'm sure it was possible then, that, you know, somebody from inner city Detroit has a lot more in common with someone from inner city Los Angeles, or that, you know,
certainly.
Whatever it is, more than they do with other people in Michigan.
Oh, sure. I mean, I think there's a handful of questions, or like this begets, you know,
mm-hmm.
a number of questions, right? First, in terms of term limits, So far, at least from what I've seen in California, because California instituted term limits for their state Senate and the state House, the difficulty becomes is that as there's more turnover, mm-hmm. right, which ostensibly would be a good thing, right? Like, mm-hmm. I mean, if you don't like the idea of career politicians, and I'm not necessarily the biggest fan of career politicians, what becomes interesting, however, is that that actually shifts the balance of power, or it seems to have shifted the balance of power in terms of towards special interests. Like, in fact, so lobbyists actually were the biggest winners in term limits in California.
Because, they never win.
But like, no, they were, yeah. I mean, because they were the only ones who weren't turning over.
Uh-huh.
Right? So they were the stable mm-hmm. kind of institution, the third mm-hmm. house, if you will. Like, oftentimes mm-hmm. lobbyists are, and, you know, lobbying institutions are seen as the third house, mm-hmm. they were the big winners out of term limits. Like, mm-hmm. I think that's something that the California people didn't necessarily, I mean, that was the law of unintended consequences.
Yeah, but it's also something that the people of California don't know. Like, I don't think that most of us, like, I had never heard that. Don't think most people are like, oh, yeah, term limits help special interests.
You know, it was actually really interesting because, okay, so term limits first, like, went into effect essentially mm-hmm. in 2000, right? Mm-hmm. And I was working for the California state government '99 and 2000 before I went back to graduate school. And so I was analyzing legislation for the state for the Senate Committee on Public Safety, which is the criminal counterpart to the judiciary, mm-hmm. right? So prisons, police, mm-hmm. you know.
Fun stuff.
Yeah, exactly. You know, really, media access to prisoners, driving while black, all sorts of stuff. This was these were the bills that I was handling at 23 years old. What was interesting, however, was that, you know, as you saw, there were a number of senators who were terming out. They were having their retirement parties and this or that, right? But it was the lobbyists who, in effect, were taking over.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like, and they knew if, you know, like there was certain old kind of stalwart, I don't even know how to put it, grumpy old men in the Senate. I don't need to name names, but because I don't want to get in trouble, they'll come after me. They're still alive. But they were the ones who were kind of keeping the lobbyists in line. Oddly enough. Oddly enough, right? And it was very, very interesting to watch the dynamics during hearings, right? Because the, you know, many of the members of the state Senate had actually, these, especially this kind of old guard of grumpy old men, they'd been in there for like 20, 30 years.
So long that they weren't going to be hoodwinked by, you know.
Exactly. And they weren't going to be pushed around. You know, they're like, I know you. I knew your dad. Your dad had the same position, right? Like, and I'd be amazed the extent to which they might berate someone. But generally, they kept the special interests at bay in a way that they, you know, we're not quite seeing as much now.
That's what, this is something that Robert Kaiser writes about a lot in So Damn Much Money. I think it was Senator Robert Byrd. Was he from West Virginia?
Yeah.
But he talks about basically, you know, it's Senator Robert Byrd, you know, has had that seat for a million years. And then at a certain point, you know, they start coming in and they're like, you need to actually start campaigning and raising money because there's this young incumbent who's going to threaten you and is raising all this crazy money. And, you know, somebody, whoever it was that they brought in, said to him, you know, you're on the Armed Services Committee. Like, you, like, there are these huge defense contractors. I'm sure that if you ask them for a campaign contribution, that they would be happy to give one. And, like, you know, he's old guard and he's like, but that would be a conflict of interest. And, you know, like, to him, because, you know, he really comes from this idea of public service and he really comes from believing that, you know, there are certain lines of separation that should be respected. This is mind-blowing to him. And whoever it was that they sent in there to have that conversation with him was like, you know, I mean, he was right. But I knew that if he didn't, he would lose. But, like, just seeing, like, you know, his heart break, because that's the point. Democracy is being sold out from under us.
Well, and you also see kind of the death of statesmanship, right? You know, I mean, like, ideally, the people who represent you would be the people who, you know, I mean, this was what was written about in the Federalist Papers, that they would act on behalf of the common good, that they would use their intelligence for the nation, right, to serve the interests of national interests. Not so much anymore. And part of that is just the amount of money flowing in and out of politics and even the worry about contenders. I mean, we saw earlier this year a primary challenge that Mike Honda faced versus a young
Mike Honda.
He represents San Jose. He's absolutely fantastic. He used to be in the California State Assembly, but he represents San Jose. One of the earliest elected officials in government. In the U.S. Congress, who happens to be of Asian American descent, former school teacher. I think he got elected to Congress in 2002. I'm not positive.
Around
then. But the thing is that, you know, Mike Honda was challenged by a young gun, for lack of a better term, named Ro Khanna. Right. Mm-hmm. Ro is much more pro-business. And
these names are amazing.
Well, yeah, but it was interesting. You know, yeah. San Jose has sizable Asian American populations. Diverse Asian American populations.
I've been to San Jose. I've seen that diverse Asian American population.
No, but
there's good Filipino food. There's good Indian American food.
It's a very diverse. Multi-ethnic area.
Yeah, and there's a large Hispanic population.
Oh, certainly.
Yeah.
And Mike Honda has, you know, represented them well for about 10 years. But now we're seeing a lot of challengers that are coming through and, you know, kind of trying to, I guess, disestablish the old guard. And I wouldn't quite put Mike Honda in the old guard category in the fact that he's been one who's come up with new ideas, who has, you know, been a very quality legislator. But you see that more and more. I mean, we saw that even in the early 2000s when Artur Davis down in Alabama unseated Earl Hilliard, who had been in office in Birmingham, Alabama. We also saw Barack Obama try to do that when he was a state senator, right? Trying to unseat...
Against Hillary Clinton. I mean, that was his whole thing. I mean...
But remember, Barack Obama lost... A congressional primary in 2000, and I can't remember why I am drawing a blank on the name, but he lost a Democratic primary for a House seat, right? Then all of a sudden, by 2008, he's a presidential.
Which is
nominee.
Crazy.
Yeah. I mean,
it's
all this
Lincoln-esque.
To say, kids, you know, life can turn on a dime.
Yeah.
Right. Like, if you want to reinvent yourself, go into politics. And then lose and then go into politics again, right? I mean, Jerry Brown, hello.
Right. But I think that's – so here's an interesting question. So I know that you are – you know Bill Dresewitz.
Dresewitz, yeah.
Who we've had on the show.
Yes.
And there
He's super.
And he is super. And there's a thread that runs through his book that sort of laments the loss of aristocracy. Because there were these people who were secure in their position and as a result were, you know, had a real ethic of public service, right? John F. Kennedy, you know, he's wealthy and he has this understanding that his privilege means that he has a responsibility to serve, right?
Certainly.
And there are people who have expressed that. I don't want to speak out of turn, but as I recall... there's something similar in Fareed Zakaria. Mm-hmm. Like, there are certain people who are now expressing, you know, that they're looking wistfully back on essentially aristocracy, which I think is frankly bizarre.
Yeah.
But in a funny way, it seems like you're also expressing something similar where you're saying, you know, by having people's positions in some sense be safe or be protected, that freed them up to be able to really focus on doing the job properly, or that long duration gave them a certain security to be able to really learn the craft of being a politician and a statesman.
Certainly. I mean, I think there is a difficulty in the sense that on the one hand, you know, you want this statesmanship, right? And it could be stateswomanship. I don't want to seem as if I'm biased. You want that. Mm-hmm. You definitely want to have people who are generally driven by the common good.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That is, I think that's a crucial element of leadership and also hopefully that are, you know, relatively capable people. Right. I mean, you could be, you know, the village idiot for Texas. And, even if you mean well, I don't know necessarily that will serve the common good, whether or not you intend to. So you have that. I think that the difficulty becomes when it stops becoming deliberative, right? Like one of the best parts of democracy, or at least one, what you would like to see out of democracy, is this idea of deliberation, that different people coming from different backgrounds, right? Which means that not necessarily an aristocracy. In fact, preferably not an aristocracy.
Well, that's my point. I don't like aristocracy.
Yeah.
I lived in England for too long.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough. I can't speak to that.
Yeah.
I've only been there for like 2 weeks at a time. I saw the Buckingham Palace. It was lovely.
Big Ben.
Whatever. I ate fish and chips.
Yeah.
But so suffice it to say, right, you have this, you know, you need people from different backgrounds, right, with ideas, with new ideas, right? The issue then again becomes the money in politics. That's what's killing the statesmanship, right? It's because you have money and ambition and, you know, and this, and it's outweighing, by far outweighing the common good. It is essentially corrupting the system from the inside out.
But I mean, Madison would say that the problem is an ambition, right? Because ambition must be made to counteract ambition, right? From the Federalist
papers. No, I mean, yeah, I don't always agree with Madison.
Well, you know,
but yes, I understand what you're saying.
But what I'm saying is the problem is that the ambition is channeled in the wrong direction, right? The ambition is channeled towards raising money rather than creating better policy for the people, and thereby out-competing others on terms of all of the things that you've actually done that benefit the people.
Well, I mean, I would go further than that. And what I would say is that, you know, like, I mean, you have a disproportionate number of egomaniacs in politics, right? And I say this having, you know, been in, like, involved in politics since I was 12, at least.
And having dated a congressperson.
That, too. Yes, thank you. Thank you, Hunter. I appreciate that.
no, but I'm just
small
saying
details.
That,
yeah, no.
No, but it's an important detail because the point is that you know you know how these people really are. Like, you've spent a lot of time in Congress, like in, you know, and in both a professional and a personal capacity.
Yeah.
Like, what I'm saying is that, you know, for me to say I've been in politics since I was 12, like, yeah, I watched the news.
Yeah, I used to hang out with all the spouses. And
yeah, you know these people intimately. Like, you know firsthand.
Had to dress up.
Right, exactly.
I like being a frumpy professor. It's much better for me. But here's the deal, is that you have, like, you know, a crowd of people, you know, that aren't necessarily running because they actually care, right? They, I mean, you do have some statesmen out there, and they are serving the public good, and they continue to fight even when all of the odds are against them, right? But what you also have is a contingent coming in that are like little glory hounds, right? And I remember talking about this in one of my Congress classes because, you know, one kid was saying, I'm going to run. I was like, why? He's like, because I like to win things.
Yeah.
And I was like,
great.
Oh, you're going to get smacked. Right.
I was worse, you're going to succeed.
Thank you.
That's the real problem. I mean, you know, I do have some friends from college who, you know, Katie, who I wrote the Straight A Conspiracy with.
Sure.
You know, we have friends from college who went into politics.
Sure.
And the problem is that, you know, the environment was so toxic and so terrible that anybody with integrity ends up leaving.
Yeah. Or gets run out. Right.
It's generally speaking, you know, you have to be a snake to survive in a snake pit.
Yeah. And that becomes a critical problem. Right. So I don't think necessarily. I mean, part of it is that the money corrupts. Right. So you have, like, you know, these a-holes who are already kind of like figuring out how they can make the absolute most money possible. So then they can run and nobody can afford to run against them. Right. Like, this is how some people think. You know, and they're not even thinking about what their issues would be. They just want to win. Win, win, win.
Well, I mean, even, you know, since I've been voting, it's amazing to see the difference in the political mailings that you get as a citizen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it used to be, I mean, you know, when in 2000, like, you would get, like, mailings that were, like, vaguely issue-related.
Yeah.
Now Barack Obama sends me these incredibly emotionally desperate emails, like, I need you, Hunter. Hunter, do this for me, Hunter.
Yeah, and now, then you're like, boo, we broke up.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. Like, girl.
I read Lawrence Lessig's book. I know that you betrayed your principles.
I'm like, Barack Obama, you got to call Tyrone. Because
yeah, but I mean, it's not only that. I mean, like, it's now they're now it's like really even reached the stage of the showcase showdown. Like, yeah. They're not even trying to attract me on values. They're like, win a trip to New York to meet Barack,
and I'm like, and oh, George Clooney,
and George Clooney. Wow, yeah. This is exciting.
Yeah. Uh huh.
You know, and you don't have to give no entry. You know, require no money required to participate. Like, you can enter for free. Like, blah blah blah. But it's like there's no way in which, you know, what are we talking about? Except for the fact that apparently the Republicans are evil and you need me desperately. Please come back to me.
Well, I remember one point, I don't know if I mentioned this before, I was interviewing members of Congress for my dissertation, which is mm-hmm. now going to be my book, Twists of Fate. And one
available 2015.
Yes, exactly. And one of the interesting things about this was that, you know, as I was interviewing members of Congress, there were, like, I interviewed this one elderly Latina woman.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she had tears in her eyes when she talked about fundraising
mm-hmm.
because she said Rahm Emanuel was chasing her down the halls,
mm-hmm.
right? And she was like, you know, I represent a district that has nothing. I can't mm-hmm. ask these people for $50. That's whether or not they eat for 2 weeks, right? She was like, and yet I have, you know, Rahm Emanuel running after me, chasing me down. Like, and she has tears, like, streaming mm-hmm. down her face.
Right.
And she's talking about this experience of, like, and this determines, of course, you know, how much money you raise determines whether or not you get the positions you want in the Democratic mm-hmm. Party. If you get... You
so, know, side note, for this woman's district, because they aren't able to raise that much money, that means they're going to get less representation because their congresswoman won't be...
Won't be, yeah.
Whatever.
Won't be, yeah. I mean, she won't be on this, you know, on this prestigious committee,
mm-hmm.
or she won't be on a committee that best will serve her district's needs,
mm-hmm.
right? And so.
Which also means that, like Senator Robert Byrd, she won't be on, say, the Armed Services Committee, so she
yeah.
won't even be able to raise, like, big money there, right?
Yeah.
So she just gets marginalized and marginalized and marginalized.
But marginalized within the structure and the way the structures work right now. Like, you know, and it's interesting to me because as much as the, you know, as much as the Democrats may talk about, like, you know, reining in, like, with ethics rules in particular and this or that, simultaneously, you know, and admittedly, the Republicans aren't talking much about that one. That's a problem unto itself, to be fair.
Mm-hmm.
But simultaneously, you still have this expectation that everyone is going to be able to raise usually at least $250,000 every 2 years.
Mm.
But realistically, if you want to be a ranking member on a committee or a or have a plum position of one form or another, then you need to be bringing in more like $500,000 every.
Right. Now let's say, I mean, I, you know, just for the sake of simplicity,
sure,
right? So let's say, like, each person has to raise $500,000.
Yeah.
But I'm this elderly Latina woman, which mm-hmm. is very, you which, know, body
yes.
dysmorphic experience for me. But, you know, so be it.
But, like, quite fun.
But quite fun. Like, you know, Freaky Friday. So,
there you go.
But so I'm this elderly Latina woman. And mm-hmm. then, you know, for me to raise that $500,000 is obviously going to take a lot more phone calls, a lot more time.
Yep.
So there's even less time available for the poor districts to mm-hmm. be able to think about the issues, to be able to read whatever bills, to be able to come up with new legislation that might actually serve the district, all of those sorts of things.
But also, if you're coming out of that district, if you're born and raised in that district, like this woman happened to be,
mm-hmm.
right, the likelihood that you have that the kind of network that's already kind of built in is substantively different. You know, this woman
mm-hmm.
didn't go to Harvard or Princeton or
mm-hmm.
Yale or blah, blah, blah. You know, I mean, she eventually graduated from college and then she became a teacher and then
mm-hmm.
and then she what have you. But, you know, with she doesn't have the networks where she has all sorts of rich friends
mm-hmm.
that she can call, you know, on mm-hmm. a day-to-day basis. She's not plugged in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's kind of another structural issue, which is, you know, you went to Harvard. I went to Princeton, right? Like, I also did some grad school.
Princeton is way snobbier than Harvard.
Dude, it's all relative.
No. Between those schools, your school is way snobbier than my school.
Okay, fine.
Relative to the rest of the world, Harvard is incredibly snobby.
Okay,
but
yes. Okay, all right. The joke roughly goes,
yeah.
you know, Harvard students say, this is how I will run the world.
Yeah.
Right? And then they very much believe that. And Princeton students say, this is how my family already does.
That's right.
Right? So just take that in mind, you know, the little
yeah.
rivalry here. And mind you, I was a financial aid student. Like, I worked in the dining hall all 4 years.
I worked in the Mather Library. It was a very noble institution.
I believe you. Yeah. I believe you. But suffice it to say, right, that you have, at least with the politics, what you have is you have money, 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 power, power, power.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just fluid throughout throughout the institution. And it affects every day of the game,
mm-hmm.
right? So when you have a poor Latina who mm-hmm. didn't get to go to a place like Harvard, didn't mm-hmm. get to go to a place like Princeton, didn't get to go to a place like UCLA even.
Right.
Right? What you're dealing with is, you know, very few options of how to raise that money that your party, mm-hmm. regardless if it's the Republicans or the Democrats, expects you to raise.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And if so, then you don't get the power, you don't get the clout.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of stuff that you could do for your district becomes increasingly limited. And it's the people in your district who need the help the most.
Well, but I mean, that's the thing is that it's bad. It's good for no one, right? Because what ends up happening is that, listen, I think so often what ends up happening is that, you know, especially Democrats, liberal mm-hmm. Democrats,
sure.
they tend to play on the empathy card, right? Like,
yeah.
we should empathize with these people who don't have a lot, right?
Sure.
Which is understandable and all that sort of stuff. But I think that's the thing is that, you know, I mean, there is something. Adam Smith didn't capture the full scope of human motivations, but he did mm-hmm. capture an important point, which is self-interest, right?
Yes.
And in terms of self-interest, the price of having people who are so massively disenfranchised for the system, like if you want to fix welfare, right, or any of these sorts of things, a large part of it is that, you know, when you disenfranchise these people and the government doesn't really work for them and they're not really included and participatory in the system, you know, they feel disengaged. Like there are all sorts of consequences there. Like there's a real, real price to that.
Oh, certainly.
And it's not, you know, I think the illusion that very often, and, you know, the privileged operate under is that, you know, like it's over there.
Yeah.
And there aren't consequences within the system, but it's you can't have one part of the body not working without it affecting every other part of the body.
Agreed.
So, you know, I mean, it really has huge consequences for all of us. It's not really about that it sucks for them. Yes, it does suck for them, but it sucks for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I mean, everyone is getting shortchanged. But I think, I mean, but then it comes to a bigger deal, which is who can afford to put food on the table and who can't, right? And
yeah, I agree. But, you know, I think that's, I mean, part of what Brian and I talk a lot about is mm-hmm. that, you know, what's happened is, and this is sort of where partisanship comes in, is that so often, you know, we sort of come up with platforms that narrowly serve the interests of particular groups, whether that be the interests of the Koch brothers,
mm-hmm.
you know, or, you know,
interests of George Soros.
Or the interests of George Soros or whatever it is, or, you know, the interests of Christian voters or the interests mm-hmm. of atheist voters or the interests of whatever. And I think we, you know, if we part of how we cross those partisan lines, because we can't expect government to fix itself, right?
Yeah.
We need to start to come together around issues like campaign finance.
Agreed.
And so we need to start to really articulate platforms that are really inclusive
mm-hmm.
in a real sense that don't just that draw on what is good for everybody. And campaign finance is bad for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's an issue that has to be fixed for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because it ends up, I mean, that's the thing. Even though the Koch brothers think they're getting what they want, the prices of distorting the system that much ultimately mean that the country as a whole is so much worse off that it actually ends up being bad for them, I would argue. I don't know that's true, but
I mean, it may. I would agree that it's bad for them. I don't know that they mind.
Well, by the way, as a wrap-up note, you know, I have to thank Katie's mom for pointing this out.
Hmm.
Apparently, the NFL is now selling off the rights to do the Super Bowl halftime show. It's going to be available for sale, and Katy Perry may buy it. But what we're really hoping for, and this was her idea, is uh-huh. that the Koch brothers are going to buy the Super Bowl halftime show and do some soft shoe. Because we think that the Koch brothers tap dancing in front of America would really, more than anything,
would do the world of justice.
And
yes.
it would really like make clear to people that, you know, money can buy
anything.
Power and influence, yeah.
Yes, yes. You can have a rapt audience.
The hashtag Koch Brothers Do Soft Shoe.
Okay. Excellent. Sounds wonderful to me.
Yeah. Thank you so much, as always, for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
Glad we finally got to districting.
Okay.
And then you and I will figure out where we go from here.
Awesome.
And Brian, I hope you're having fun in the woods, because we're having fun without you.
Yeah.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.